Welcome to Oh This World.
This is a podcast for people inclined to take action in the age of coronavirus. As Americans and as Texans, we wonder about the choices we are personally making in this new world disorder.
And because our state and federal governments have failed to provide the leadership necessary to help all of us make informed decisions, it sometimes seems like we're all on our own.
But at a time when it's easy to feel helpless, we're focused on action. I'm Antoinette Perez.
And I'm Lucas Schaefer. We're friends, engaged citizens, and progressive activists in Austin, Texas.
Our mission is to help Texans and people across the country hold our leaders accountable and build an America that leaves no one behind.
So wash your hands, grab a drink, and join us for Oh This World.
Welcome to Oh This World. Today, we will tackle one piece of corporate accountability.
Woo!
Hi, Lucas. How was your weekend, friend?
Hello, Antoinette. It was fine. It's getting a little warm in these parts here in Austin, Texas. But, you know, that's just part of the deal.
It's May in Austin, Texas, and I don't think we've hit 100 yet this year, have we?
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't think we have, but many, many hot days are ahead of us. I am certain of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know if that's going to affect the virus at all. We've all been waiting for this onset of hot weather to see if it helps us or not.
I'm not going to be counting on that.
Nor am I. Just curious. Maybe a little bit hopeful.
Yeah. Hope is good.
Hope is good. So you have some follow-up items for us today.
Oh, God. I feel like this disinformation episode we did last week, we're going to be following up on it at least until November, if we can dislodge some of the worst disinformation disseminators. And probably for the rest of our lives, we'll be following up. Oh, This World episode 10,000, combating disinformation again.
Part 700.
Oh, yeah. So here's what I'm noticing that I just thought I'd call attention to. We're in past the buck territory right now. Mm-hmm. The Trump administration, the Abbott administration, failed on testing, didn't use the time that we, the American people, gave them to get their acts together, right? That's why we all stayed home, right?
Right.
Get the testing out there. Get everyone on the same page. And they essentially did nothing, as far as I can tell, or certainly not much. And so now we're in pass the buck territory, right? So now we're in all the different reasons why it's actually not the Trump administration's fault and actually not the Republican Party's fault that we're in this completely preventable mess. So I just want to call attention to part of what we do here is I feel like there's an analogy. I don't know what the analogy is, but I take all of the toxicity that is being thrown out there and I absorb it into my body, and then I regurgitate just a little. I let go of a little bit of it so you can hear what the toxicity is, but then the rest of it just stays within me, slowly draining me of energy and life, or maybe actually giving me energy and life. I think I thrive off of this sort of toxic waste.
It could be a superpower. I'm going to think on it.
I don't know. There's some analogy there. Okay, so some bits of disinformation I'm seeing. One talking point that I just love that we're going with now is, have you heard this one, Antoinette? Why are the red states supposed to bail out the blue states who have been so mismanaged?
Yes.
Oh my goodness, where even to begin? Let's start here. AP fact check. From the end of 2017, blue high-tax states fund red low-tax states. So just to give you an example from this AP article, and we'll post it, Mississippi residents, right? Mississippi the state of Mississippi receives $2.13 for every tax dollar the state sends to Washington, right? West Virginians, $2.07 for every dollar sent to Washington. Kentucky, $1.90. Meanwhile, New Jersey, 74 cents in federal spending for every tax dollar the state's sending to Washington. So in reality, right, blue states are subsidizing red states. That is how it has been for years and years. Today we have Greg Abbott tweeting out this ridiculous chart that includes the phrase morality rate. Morality rate instead of mortality rate, which, so, you know, he's promoting this with this chart. I'm not going to post the chart because we're not just going to put total nonsense out there for you. But Dave Weigel on Twitter notes that this chart, which makes it seem as if California has this giant deficit and Texas has a perfectly balanced budget, Dave Weigel notes that California had a surplus until, guess what, the pandemic. Right. And the Texas budget forecast isn't due till July. So we don't know what the pandemic, how the pandemic affects Texas's budget. So this is just a total nonsense blue state bailout. All of these Republicans with their stock portfolio concerns, you know, if the economies of California and New York collapse, I don't know if they're going to be so happy with how their portfolios look. And that's also just not even to touch on the non-economic benefits we get from these blue states, like cultural benefits, like the movies we go to, the books we read, the fashion we wear, blah, 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 blah. So this is just, it's a silly talking point designed to distract from reality. So that was one I wanted to point out. A second one I wanted to point out, which is even more insidious and evil, Alex Azar, is that how you say this person's name? The Health and Human Services Secretary? These people last for such short, they're so in and out that even learning their names sometimes feels like, I guess he's been around a while, but you know what I mean. So he came out today and he said that the reason the American population is disproportionately dying from coronavirus. Did you see what he said, Antoinette?
Because you told me what he said.
Comorbidities, unhealthy comorbidities. And then he goes on to say, oh, God, these people, this is an Alex Azar quote. Unfortunately, the American population is very diverse. Could we just pause there and say he's saying he's preceding the American population is very diverse with unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, the American population is very diverse, and it is a population with significantly unhealthy comorbidities that do make many individuals in our communities, in particular African-American minority communities, particularly at risk because of underlying health conditions. Oh, where to begin? Where to even begin with this nonsense? The reason we are in this situation, one, is because of the criminal, epic unpreparedness of the Donald Trump administration. Where are the tests? We weren't prepared. We weren't ready. They failed. That's why we're there. Second of all, this goes back to our story last week about as soon as we saw more black and brown people dying, suddenly, oh, let's reopen the economy. The demographic that, quote, unquote, matters is not at risk, right? So this is all just playing into stereotypes and nonsense because the Trump administration refuses to take responsibility for its actions. And I just want to say one other thing. As we're going to blame the American people now for dying because of Donald Trump's unpreparedness, if we want to talk about pre-existing conditions in the American population, one, I would point out that Republicans are trying to get rid of protections for pre-existing conditions. And soon, coronavirus will probably be a pre-existing condition, right? If you survive coronavirus, I mean, it could be. It's up to the insurance companies, I guess, to define that, right? If we left it up to them, as opposed to having the government do that. So that's one thing. And just the other thing I just want to point out is there is something so rich about this administration and the Republican Party going after Americans for pre-existing conditions when, if you recall, Michelle Obama, 4 years, what was her version of Be Best, which is like a fake thing? Hers was real, right? It was getting kids to exercise more, eating more vegetables, all of these things. Republicans had a freaking meltdown. Oh my God, you know why I said that? Because I'm not a freaking person. I'm not a friggin' person. I'm the full thing. And when we first started this podcast, there was a little box that said, are you explicit content? And I thought, we're not explicit content. And I've never checked the box. So now I say these words that might be the first time that word has ever passed
left your mouth.
These lips. I say the full thing, but her whole thing was, let's be healthier, and Republicans had a meltdown about this for years, and now they're saying, oh, people aren't healthy. It's just the lying, the mendacity, the racism, the nonsense.
The finger pointing, the deflection. Yes.
Okay. Now, this, though, is, God, I love a wind-up. I love a wind-up. I'm okay with the pitch, but I love the windup. This is what I wanted to say, though, as it relates to all of the disinformation stuff we talked about. I do think it's important to call Republicans out when they create these narratives that are just so ridiculous. But I also think we need to get better at just framing the debate on our own terms. The entire debate cannot just be us responding to every nonsense claim Republicans make, right? So that's why I keep saying, where are the tests? Where are the tests? Where are the tests? Where are the tests? I mean, repetition, we know, matters, right? And you can't counter their narrative just with your narrative is incorrect. You need to have a counter narrative. And in our case, as we've said before, there, I said it again, we have the advantage of actually having our narrative be true, right? This is actually planet Earth reality narrative. So all of this is to say I became aware of an interchange this last week between a constituent in our district and some of the staff members who work for a congressman whose name I'm not going to say today. Just going to take a break from saying
the name.
Let's
keep the space pure.
Keeping the space pure. But you know, we don't need to get into the details, but it was another one of these sort of Gish Gallop situations where the constituent had honest questions and was just being bombarded with irrelevant facts and countless, look at this site, look at this site, look at this site, look at this site. And I just think it's important when we're calling our representatives, when we're writing letters to the editor, when we're getting out and talking to our friends and neighbors from 6 feet away about why we need to support Wendy Davis in Texas 21 and Joe Biden at the top of the ticket and all the Democrats all the way down. I just think it's important we stick to our narrative and we don't allow these Republicans to just gish gallop right over us. And part of that is going back. If you ask your representative a question and the answer you get back doesn't make any sense to you because there's jargon, because there's this, because there's look at this, don't you know about this? I think the natural response from a non-sociopath is to say, oh my God, there's so much I don't know. Right? Like maybe I really haven't done my research because you're a normal person who's trying to engage on the level. And I think you just need to remember, no. If you don't understand what they're saying, it's because a clear answer from them, they don't see as beneficial to them. So you know, it is a congressman's job and the job of a congressman's staff to clearly articulate the positions of that person and to clearly respond to direct questions with direct answers. And if they refuse to do that, you need to go back at them with those questions again, as opposed to getting sidetracked in whatever nonsense they want to go down. Don't open the links. The links are BS. The links are useless. Don't open the links. If you've got a question, where are the tests, or whatever the question is, you know what the question is. Ask the question. Get an answer. If they don't want to answer, go back to the question. And if they just want to continue on and on and on, at some point, you know, life is short. Life is short.
Life is so short.
So that was a wind-up and a long pitch. Long wind-up, long pitch.
What's funny about that to me is that you started the follow-up section by saying, oh, where to begin? And I felt the same exact way when on Friday we had said we would talk about corporate accountability today. And then I started going down that path. I asked myself where to begin. There was a long route to today's episode. And we are definitely going to touch on, I'm sure, some of the very things that you just followed up on. I made a mind map. I think that's what it's called. Have you ever mind mapped, Lucas?
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I think it's just a fancy way of saying, like, around a topic, you dump out all ideas, words, phrases, possibilities, and then you find how they're connected and you draw some lines and things like that. Mm. I did a mind map around corporations and corporate accountability because the abuse of corporate power, the ensuing wealth inequality has been a minor obsession of mine for many years. And it's such a giant topic that I've never had to put it all together into some succinct 45-minute package like I tried to do today.
Yes.
And there's a lot because every modern social and cultural ill that I could think of somehow has a line drawn between it and corporate accountability and corporate power and corporate dominance. It's challenging. So I had to ask myself, where do we even begin to start framing the discussion today? And I think a definition is always a very good place to start. So What is a corporation? Oxford Dictionary says a corporation is a company or group of people authorized to act as a single entity, and then in parentheses, legally a person, and recognized as such in law.
Wait, so after all this, corporations really are people?
Apparently so. There's a lot of nuance to that and a lot of depth and a lot of history. So I'll touch on some pieces of that. But I think we all have heard that this is the case and maybe didn't understand how it worked. So today we'll try and investigate a couple of those different layers. I found another definition for a corporation that I thought was far more entertaining. And I thought you would appreciate this.
I'm ready.
Mr. Schaefer. Ambrose Bierce, writer, satirist, critic, defined a corporation as an ingenious device for obtaining profit without individual responsibility.
Ooh, without individual responsibility. That could be the slogan of an entire political party at this point. The one that especially loves, they both like corporations, but one especially.
One especially. Yeah, obtaining profit without individual responsibility. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to go deep into modern corporations.
Ooh, fantastic.
I want to clarify before we jump into this that there may be independent businesses, small local businesses that are great community actors, community members. They hire locally, they do business locally, they support local schools and everything, communities, which is great. They may be incorporated. And that's not really who we're here to focus on today. We are talking about a specific set of business entities that now we know are also considered legally people in many respects, who are abusing that power. And frankly, left unchecked, I think a lot of corporations might continue to grow and abuse that power. I don't know.
And, well, and also you can use some common sense in terms of how do we know corporations abuse power by donating to politicians, right? Who then create lack of regulations and rules that favor them unfairly. So mom and pop shops are probably not giving mega donations to Ted Cruz or whoever, right?
Mom and pop shops are also not hiring lobbyists and engaging in that sort of political, what's the word I'm looking for? Abuse, just abuse.
Unless you're a Dallas hairdresser with a GoFundMe account
with a political agenda,
yes.
$500,000 GoFundMe account, exactly. Mm-hmm. Corporations have built so much economic and political power that sometimes they feel unstoppable. And it hasn't been that long that they have been on this path to where they are now. So corporations are really things, but also at their core, they are comprised of groups of people like you and me, but they don't always act like you and I would. And that definition of profit, the word profit, I think was in both of the definitions that I had mentioned right before the break. Mm. The whole priority of profit first, I think, defines the challenges of modern capitalism in that the profit comes before anything else, which leads some of these bad actors to human rights violations, like continued human rights violations, mm-hmm. Environmental destruction, mm-hmm. all of those things. So the end result of modern capitalism gone awry is often a handful of individuals who have benefited personally at the expense of public good.
Sure.
So the history lesson. And now we're going to see if I can try to put this in a 3-minute package. And I do want to go in chronological order to go from like farthest back till now. Now, by the way, I had read almost all the things that I'm about to tell you here, but I never really put them in order. And when you see it on a timeline, it's something else. Let's start as far back as the 13th century.
Oh, boy.
3 minutes. I'm trying.
Okay. The timer is on.
The timer is on. In Europe, as far back as the 13th century, there are records of corporations that were initially created as nonprofit entities that were essentially doing a short-term project that would serve the public good. So things like building buildings, physical buildings or institutions, they would be started a lot of times with a charter that would run from a few years to maybe at maximum like 40 years, but they were never really intended to have long-term lifespans. They were there to do something that would help their local areas, and then they would be done and dissolved. But by the 1600s, when we started to see trade going across oceans and things like that, we started including profit and colonizing in this definition of what is in the public interest. And that started out really benign, you know, trading tea, and then maybe trading some opium, and eventually trading slaves. And then, you know, when you get to colonizing in America, Americans eventually, as we know, shrugged off colonial England and really took up the mantle of capitalism in our own new American way. And the pendulum started swinging in the late 19th century to unchecked capitalism, to where the government had to step in at the turn of the century and make some corrections by introducing a wave of legislation that was antitrust and anti-monopoly oriented. So I want to slip a little tiny thing in here because it fits chronologically, although I'm going to come back to it later in the timeline and talk about it more. The whole concept of corporate personhood actually started in 1886 in the United States. Yeah, I know, it was that far back, and it kind of laid dormant for a long time. It wasn't picked up again for almost 100 years. But the idea that a corporation could also be considered a person was related to the drafting of the 14th Amendment in the late 19th century. So I'll come back to that in just a minute, because as we know, the government did step in, tried to make sure that they were checking corporations. And from like the post-Depression era through the middle of the 20th century, big corporations publicly, openly acknowledged that their purpose of existence was to create value for many stakeholders, not just shareholders. And in fact, shareholders often took last place in the list of priorities behind customers, suppliers, employees and workers, right? Creditors, all of those people and shareholders took last place. And we started to see that shift in the 60s and 70s. Because as the government was imposing more environmental and consumer safety types of regulations on businesses, companies started learning that they could hire lobbyists to push back. So this was the rise of the golden age of the lobbyist. Mm. And initially, they were pushing back against what they saw as overreaching regulation from the government. But by the 80s, they were taking advantage of this constant chipping away of the social safety net to where labor was weakening, the government was solidly becoming more pro-business. Mm-hmm. And lobbyists went from playing a game of defense to playing a game of offense and starting to campaign for legislation that would benefit their corporate clients. It's interesting because if you go down the little rabbit hole, like I did, of looking into lobbying and understanding that relationship of lobbyists and their clients, it really is like a self-perpetuating business, because the more that the lobbyist is able to show that they are providing, you know, both political information and strategy, the more that the client feels like they need them, and they end up expanding their whole lobbying capacity. It's just, it's big. So now we can come back to this corporate personhood piece, because in recent times, this corporate personhood concept has been built on by successive cases that lead us to where we are now. In 1886, that case that went up in front of the Supreme Court where corporate personhood became a thing, it was called Santa Clara versus the Southern Pacific Railroad. And essentially, one of the authors of that 14th Amendment, the U.S. Senator Roscoe Conkling, he argued in front of the Supreme Court that the congressional committee that drafted the 14th Amendment used the word person to include corporations. And then that Supreme Court just sort of said, you know, off the cuff, hey, in our headnote, we agree. We think that this is the case, that the word person in this case was intended to include corporations as well. So I read this really great piece for the Brennan Center for Justice, written by a woman named Ciara Torres Spalisi. I think that's mm-hmm. how you pronounce her name.
Okay.
And she says in her piece for Brennan Center that corporate personhood is a legal fiction. And when she says legal fiction, she says the Supreme Court in 1886 didn't even really hand down this determination that corporations should be considered people as like part of their ruling or their mm-hmm. decision. They just kind of like made this off the cuff comment. But in 1970, in a case called Bellotti, it ended up granting corporations the First Amendment right to spend unlimited corporate funds on ballot initiatives. So it's like a whole case that was predicated on this off-the-cuff comment in 1886, which actually leads to Citizens United in 2010, in which the Supreme Court said political speech is indispensable to decision-making in a democracy, and this is no less true because a speech comes from a corporation.
This all reminds me of that. Have you ever seen that great bumper sticker, "I'll believe corporations are people when Texas executes one"?
I have never seen that.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
That is a good one.
That's a good one. But this is sort of, okay.
There's one more, though. There's more. One more.
Of course.
Which is, in 2014, Supreme Court ruled in favor of Hobby Lobby in that giant decision.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Citing Citizens United, saying that now a corporation can make a religious objection to a generally applicable law like a person would. So we've expanded all of the rights of a corporation without the leaders of that corporation really having the same consequences that individuals have. Like, they have the protections of a corporation. So Here's a funny thing. I started making a list of all of the times where I remembered corporate crimes, questionable corporate behavior that was under investigation. And I came up with a handful. And then I found a New York Times article that gave me many, many, many more. And as I read through them, these are all kind of the last 10 years, I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that one. I forgot about that one. Yeah. On my personal list, Wells Fargo defrauding its own customers, right? Incentivizing its workers to succeed at any cost, and those people opening false accounts in the names of their existing customers. I remembered Volkswagen and the so-called Dieselgate, where they were doing like emissions misreporting and cheating and basically violating the Clean Air Act. I remembered, of course, Hershey and Nestle, because every year around Halloween, we are encouraged to make sure that we buy like responsible things to give away for Halloween instead of candy from these places that are probably exploiting child labor somewhere in their long supply chains. You and I have geeked out about a couple of these. Very recent Theranos Fire Festival with Billy McFarland and WeWork, which is the newest one. These are all examples of like corporate bad actors, just people who fit a mold, and we want to glorify them and put them up on this stage and believe what they have to say, when in fact what they might be saying is fraudulent, untrue, disinformation.
What if I told you, Antoinette, that this is not my actual voice, that this is my Elizabeth Holmes voice, and I actually sound like this? Did you have any idea?
No. I was so obsessed. I think I went through a whole day just trying out a lower voice just to see what that was like. She is something else. And I don't think she's still in, I don't think she's in jail yet.
You know, you also listened to some of the as you were doing all of this research, which I didn't know most of this. I mean, did it surprise you? It did surprise you.
I just hadn't put it in one package before. These are stories. This is news. This is information and history that I've been reading about for, you know, 10 years. I just didn't put it in this package. And I have to read to you in this New York Times article. Maybe we'll link to it. Maybe not. The story's fine. S&P agreed to pay $1.375 billion in 2015 to settle civil charges that it inflated ratings on mortgage-backed securities at the heart of the financial crisis. I'm just reading to you these companies because Siemens, 2008, foreign bribery case. We also have Tyson Foods. We have Pfizer. We have Walmart. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
I mean, to me, this is just what, this is the whole reason you need some government regulation. I mean, it's, I don't know why we'd expect any of these corporations to behave responsibly without being forced to do so. I mean,
that's the irony of this. No. They've become so powerful that really the only entity out there that can keep that power in check is the government. And we still have folks out there, individuals just like you and me, who are paying the price in a lot of cases for bad corporate behavior. We have a lot of people just like us out there going, regulation is bad. We shouldn't be regulating entrepreneurs and job creators. And we just have this whole like vocabulary to protect this myth of the business, the entrepreneur, the corporation, all of that. When corporations do wrong, who pays the price? Like you and I do as customers, the employees do, the shareholders often do, not necessarily the executives that were in charge of making sure that corporation was doing the right thing to begin with.
No, I mean, that's why we have the golden parachute, right? Mm-hmm. That great phrase, but I think as with many things in our world, common sense, right, dictates, we got to have some rules. We got to have some rules, right? And then we use all of these words and come up with these excuses and these stories to not do the thing that's just basic common sense.
We have so many excuses. Our culture around you know, exceptionalism and individualism, very, very distinctly American, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. These are the ways that we make excuses for this repeat bad behavior and the lack of rules and regulations. I wanted to point out before we talk about, you know, corporations and the pandemic, that in very, very recent history, it is proven that a lot of people see this common sense that you're just talking about. Even the zillionaires, the very people who have benefited the most from modern capitalism, they know it's not working.
Yeah.
I remember reading around the Occupy Times that Warren Buffett came out and said, this inequality is not good. It's not going to last forever. And we have to do something to fix it. Of course, he wasn't offering to, you know, do anything personally. He was just sort of making that comment. There was an entire section of like an NPR episode or something where they interviewed several folks who were multi-billionaires that were saying this is not a sustainable system that we're in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bill Gates recently, I don't know if you saw this, but he was suggesting that he and Warren Buffett and Elon Musk be invited to match a giving pledge during coronavirus where, you know, they give back to society. I don't know if you saw any of that. Well, AOC and her response to that was just so lovely.
I mean, was it, why don't you pay an appropriate amount of taxes?
Pretty much. And actually, she didn't say it per se. She kind of said something like, if you want to think about it like a subscription service where you get a functioning society around you, then you could think of it that way. Someone else had commented and said, that sounds a lot like an income tax.
Well, I mean, right. If you want to do that, you should be lobbying. These powerful people should be lobbying their senators to revert to Eisenhower era tax rates.
Now, the Senate has tried to do things. So there have been legislative attempts. There was a Reward Work Act a couple years ago, and Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced the Accountable Capitalism Act. There's not enough support for it right now. So if those bills were something that were in play, we would probably be doing a call to action around those today, but they're not. So here's where we are. We're in a pandemic. We see these corporations at a point of vulnerability that we've never really seen them at before. We're watching labor trying to make a comeback. And I think that this is a good time for us to take stock of the ways that we may be unconsciously supporting corporate domination. So I want to put these thoughts out there. I know that I have been reevaluating the way that I'm thinking about things and how I'm interacting with people about this. So let me just run through this list really quick. Mm-hmm. We've got to stop as a society reflexively glorifying the entrepreneur and individualism, because teamwork always makes the dream work. It's true. In business, especially in business, it's about everybody else. So I think that it's smart for us at this point to find role models that we can lift up to be models, not only for ourselves, but for everyone around us and the young people around us, and to stop buying into this idea of, you know, it's got to be this lone entrepreneur myth. I also think that aspiring to the corporate mogul dream is a big challenge. Modern capitalism does not appear to be a system that is likely to change from the inside out, at least not in our lifetimes. So I have long been suspicious of, you know, the whole lean in philosophy. I'm thinking, let's lean out and dream up some new systems and new ways of doing and being. Not asking tough questions, especially of the corporations like that we may be big fans of. Tough questions about how they're operating, how they treat their employees, all of those things. And then taking our business elsewhere when we should. This is a great time for us to reevaluate how we're spending our money, how we're voting with our pocketbooks, as they say. And then the next couple of suggestions are, they're really, they're theoretical. One is, we got to make sure we stop labeling ideas that we don't know enough of in a way that makes it easy for us to just automatically reject them without really learning more about them. So, and this goes for people that are around us and close to us too. I think socialism is a trigger word for a lot of people. They don't really know what it means. They just sort of have this idea that socialism means communism and living in a dictatorship and all of these like bizarre things without really understanding what it is, what it means, and how it could actually benefit us. Socialism, unions, things like that, can't just automatically reject. And I do think that, you know, back to a point that we made earlier today, we have to be able to engage with others in productive conversations when we hear the types of arguments that we know are full of fallacy, like, you know, corporations are overregulated. This type of talk is nonsense. It doesn't make common sense, as you pointed out, Lucas. So we want to make sure that we start to engage in those conversations and really encourage people to do the work with us and learn and engage with us and challenge our own thinking.
Now, can I want to push back on just one of those ideas, because I agree. I agree with all of them. I agree with all of them. When we're talking about terms like socialism, right, it is a little bit of a two-way street, because I also think there are people who are so committed to, I am a democratic socialist, that's the biggest thing, that suddenly what they're actually advocating for, which is very similar to what many people who consider themselves Democrats, not democratic socialist, but just Democrats, right? Mm-hmm. I just think it's possible to get too caught up in the terms the other way, and that sometimes, I mean, I think if Bernie Sanders had said, I'm an FDR Democrat, mm-hmm. I don't know. I think a lot of those, I think if that's how he'd positioned himself for years and years, some of those concerns may have gone away. I mean, it just seemed a little silly to me that we kept going back to this, no, I am a Democrat. I'm not saying Bernie did. Oh, God. I'm not opening up this can of worms.
I was going to say all the hate mail is going to come in. No, I'm teasing. I'm teasing.
I
get what you're saying. I think you probably remember on our sheet around possible topics that one of them that I have pitched is labels, right? I think that labels are important. I don't even know where to begin in leading an episode on it, but you're cutting to the heart of that issue, which is the words that we use, they can be abused in multiple directions. So,
well, I just think it's important to keep one's eyes on the prize a little bit. And also, the other reason I feel like that is because I do think, you know, one thing I've said before is if you're an organizer who is not into coalition building, what do you think you're organizing? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's actually widespread agreement about the need to rein in corporations. If you go by individual issue. Mm-hmm. So all I'm saying is I just think we need to be open to people who we may agree with basically philosophically, but who label themselves in these different ways. And that's a two-way street.
But yeah. Good point.
Okay.
Appreciate
that. Thank you.
This final thought that I had was the very last one, and it happened in a separate writing session, which is sometimes we treat our activism and our organizing work like we are capitalists, which means that if we don't see the short-term gain, profit, electoral win, whatever, that we don't want to do the work. And what we know is that we must be here to play the long game. We can't just be in it for this election. We can't just be in it for this candidate. We can't just be in it for that particular bill or policy. We've got to be here and we've got to do the work every single day. So when we come back, we'll talk about a couple of calls to action for us.
Okay, we are back. Antoinette, thank you for this. I would call it an expansive history of corporations. What are we supposed to do?
I have a feeling that if I say, call your senators, call your congressperson, there might be a miniature revolt from the listeners of Oh This World. So we've got a couple of slightly different CTAs. Knowing that in this pandemic, we do have corporations that are rethinking a lot of what they're doing and how they're operating, this is an opportune time for us to flex our muscles as consumers and to make sure that we are putting our money where responsible business is. And you can interpret that how you like, but I would say that, you know, digging into the practices, business practices of our favorite businesses, demanding better or routing our money to alternate, say, I don't know, small local and or independent businesses would be one way that we can take immediate action.
And maybe also holding corporations in your own life accountable for how they have done during this pandemic.
Yes.
Because as we've seen, even with smaller businesses here in Austin, some have clearly put the health and welfare of their employees and their consumers,
that's right,
as the top priority, and some have not. And we should probably be, there are some, I mean, I know these aren't the big corporations we're talking about, but there are some restaurants that I may be cutting out of my life. Not, I have to say, all of my favorite restaurants, as far as I can tell, have been pretty darn good. That is damn an explicit? I don't know, but
I can lower your audio on that word so that you don't have to check the box.
Oh my god, I still haven't recovered from freaking.
That's freaking amazing.
Oh boy.
Hey, so you and I met several times, by the by, at Patica, which is one of our favorite little coffee places to go. Did you get their survey about coming back to Patica?
I didn't.
Okay.
Is that how you say it? Is it Patica?
I think it's Patica.
It's Patica. Okay.
And I did get it, and I looked at their survey, and I completed it for them, and to me it was both a gesture of caring for me and what I think and what's going to make me more likely to come back, and also just felt like good business practices. So very, very good point, and Patica's doing it, Lucas. So
excellent. We will be back there when it's safe to do so. And there
maybe.
No, well, yeah. Eventually.
Eventually.
Maybe.
It's hard for me to see that far out. Maybe.
Yeah. Well,
maybe.
Did we have other actions?
Second call to action. Cultivate a conversation on social media about good corporate behavior. If that looks like you sharing a story, maybe about a business that you like, or a business that has some questionable practices and ethics right now, then do it. But cultivate that conversation. I've really come around, Lucas. You have challenged me. Prior to Oh This World, the podcast, I wrote off all social media activism. And I just thought, you know, anybody can copy and paste a link to a news story. But now I'm starting to see that there could be some real potential to reach people.
Well, and as we've said many times before, oh boy, that is my new cliche. I always say that. I mean, we've been doing this for a month, so this is sort of like the guy on Love is Blind saying, I remember the first time I saw you. It's like, yes, that was a month ago. But as we've said before, right, it's not an either or. I mean, social media is not a good substitute for canvassing, when that's a possibility.
Or calling your elected official.
Right. It's not a good substitute for any of these things. But I also think it's just kind of silly at this point, especially during a pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. Where people are on social media, not everyone, but that is a venue. The content we create does have an effect on, you know, the people in our circles. I think you have to take it seriously. I don't think it can be a substitute for all of the other things you need to do.
Yeah, it's not a substitute. I know that for me personally, not being someone who loves being on social media, it is a challenge to invite this level of conversation and possibly invite the trolling that will come with it. And I think it might be worth it. So I'm just letting you know, you have inspired me and I will try.
And I do like Bernie, so we don't need to have any. I was making a point about everyone can do better. Everyone can do better. Could I just say one other thing as we're talking about this?
That of course.
I feel like there's, you know, we all kind of try to do our best in terms of, you know, I want to support our, you know, book people here and do a lot of the time, but sometimes I need something off Amazon and that just, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And I do think that when we're talking about individual responsibility, we can acknowledge that it's great to do our very best each time and that we all should, but also that the problems are, these are structural problems. So to keep that in mind as well. Not as a way of not doing the right thing, but just, you know, I feel like sometimes there's so much emphasis on the individual because it's a way of looking away from what the actual problem is. Which is not to say, don't go buy 50 books off Amazon right now if you can support your local bookseller. But you know what I'm saying? It's kind of, as individuals, we all have responsibilities, but we also have a responsibility to look at these big structures, and when they're not working, to advocate for change of the structures rather than just saying, well, the most important thing is that I never drink out of a bottle of water.
Right. Plastic bottle. Yes. Right. Yeah, I got you.
A plastic.
Yeah. And to take actions individually, structurally, to take every action that we can, as small as they may be, on a regular basis. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. I'm excited because on Wednesday, we are going to look at an extension a little bit of today, which is Lucas is preparing an episode on how we can come out of this pandemic into the new world with some expanded political imaginations.
Yes. I'm curious about what those big changes we want to see are. And that's what we're going to talk about.
I can't wait. So in the meantime, come say hello to us on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at othisworldpod, or you can send us an email at othisworldpod@gmail.com. You can always find our podcast on all of the usual channels. So if you like our podcast, tell a friend, and wherever you listen, please subscribe and give our podcast a rating. And Lucas and I will see you soon. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks, Antoinette. That was great. Bye.